Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 07-3100, United States of America versus Terry Davis Appellant. Mr. Axum for Appellant, Ms. Kelly for Appellee.
May it please the court, counsel. Tony Axum representing Appellant Terry Davis. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Davis is entitled to reversal of his convictions because, in violation of Federal Rule of Evidence 408, the district court admitted Mr. Davis's statement offering to compromise with his fraternity, amounts that were in dispute with regard to the validity and the amount, and those statements prejudiced him. Mr. Davis also seeks reversal on counts 11 and 12 of the indictment, charging D.C. code offenses because the district court constructively amended the indictment through the jury instructions on these counts, also prejudicing Mr. Davis. Turning to Rule 408, by its plain terms, it prohibits the use of evidence offered to prove liability for, invalidity of, or amount of claims disputed as to the validity or amount. Mr. Davis's offer to split what the fraternity told him was missing from its accounts qualified as an offer to compromise under this rule. As a result, it should have been excluded. Instead, the district court admitted it under a theory of consciousness of guilt. In a criminal case,
if he were trying to buy off a criminal investigation, that wouldn't trigger 408, would it?
That is correct. If he were trying to obstruct justice in some way, it would not trigger Rule 408.
Well, the rule doesn't talk about obstruction of justice, and I notice that that you anticipate that, but it talks about obstructing an investigation, and it's not clear to me that the obstruction is the same as the what constitutes the crime of obstruction of justice. But be that as it may, at the time that your client had this conversation, had the president or treasurer of the fraternity referred the matter to the FBI?
I don't recall exactly, but my impression is that
in June that the referral took place.
This conversation was in April.
April. I think it was in the summer of 2003. Are you sure?
I'm not sure.
I think it was in the summer, and I guess June's the summer. But
what I can say to that is that there's no evidence that Mr. Davis was aware of any investigation, or that anyone, and there's no evidence that anyone had been contacted.
I know, but it doesn't seem to me that everything turns on his intent. Because in order to have a negotiation, you have to have two sides to it, and if the treasurer was aware that there was an ongoing FBI investigation going on, it seems rather unlikely that he would be engaging in a negotiation to compromise.
Certainly, that's correct. But the rule does not prohibit statements solely made in the context of negotiations. The rule is very broad, and it prohibits the use of offers to compromise. And the policy rationale under that is that an offer to compromise would a party such as Mr. Davis would not necessarily have a way to know whether a referral had been made. But at the same time, may still want to resolve the dispute, and the court would still like to encourage resolution without it reaching either civil litigation or criminal litigation. To back up for a minute, I'd say to the court that Mr. Davis's intent is important,
I agree with you. I didn't mean to suggest that his intent didn't matter.
Yes. With regard to whether he was trying to buy someone off, I'd say that it really is only his intent and not what Mr. Hammond, with whom he was having the conversation, thought. But Even with regard to an offer, it certainly...
If one person begins by saying, look, can't we work this out? And the other person says, look, you want to negotiate with me or you want to try to compromise, call my lawyer.
And the rule would prohibit the use of the first person statement because it prohibits offers. And then in part A2, it prohibits conduct or statements made in compromise negotiations, which appear to sound much more formal than simply the offer. This offer, I would say, even if Mr. Hammond had no intention, I'd submit that the record suggests that Mr. Hammond was not closed, the fraternity was not closed to it because he said he made a counter statement. It's not $29,000, it's $100,000, and if you'd like to discuss settlement, speak with the lawyer for the fraternity. So there's absolutely no evidence or suggestion that any party thought that this was anything other than an offer to compromise. The court admitted it to show consciousness of guilt, and in a criminal case, liability really is the same as culpability. It's the same as guilt, and therefore, because the rule prohibits the use of such offers to compromise, to show liability, this offer clearly falls within the ambit of the rule and never should have been admitted. In fact, the commentary to the rule explicitly states an offer or acceptance. And to go back to the court's question before about whether Mr. Hammond, it required both parties to believe that these were compromise negotiations, because either an offer or acceptance, an offer would be by one party, acceptance by another, either party unilaterally can invoke this rule to prohibit the use of the offer by Mr. Davis, or if Mr. Hammond thought that this was that he somehow accepted the acceptance by Mr. Hammond.
Mr. Jackson, 408A requires that there be a dispute,
right,
about the validity or the amount of the claim. What is there to show that here?
When Mr. Hammond initially says that $29,000 is missing, what happened to it? And that is the fraternity's figure. Mr. Davis says that money was transferred to the payroll accounts. Mr. Davis's position throughout this trial was that money was transferred to different accounts to cover fraternity expenses. For Mr. Hammond to say that the money is missing and Mr. Davis to say no, it's not missing, we have a dispute. That is the dispute. And
The district court said there wasn't a dispute. It said that the district judge said that there was an internal investigation going on at the time by the fraternity to find out what happened to its money. And so he concluded there was no dispute, and we review that for abuse of discretion, right?
Yes.
So given what he says, can you say that, I mean, maybe you're right, but why is what the district judge did an abuse of discretion?
The district judge said that there was no dispute, but did not point to facts that established that there was no dispute.
You're saying just an error.
That's an error, yes, without a doubt. Mr. Davis did not say, okay, the money is missing. Mr. Davis at all times said that the money has been transferred from the time of this first conversation throughout trial. Now, the district court may have decided that Mr. Davis is lying, but that was a conclusion for the jury to decide, not for the district court to decide at the outset. If a defendant had to prove that he was actually entitled, and I believe that's how the district court phrased it, that the defendant first has to establish that he's entitled to, that he has a legitimate right to the funds, the rule would be meaningless. You would have to have a whole trial first, because Mr. Davis at the outset said, no, the money was transferred. So I'd say that the district court was not entitled to that the evidence didn't support that conclusion by the district court.
Can I just want to be clear about one thing. The district court's ruling occurred in limine.
That is correct.
Before evidence was presented. After the this individual, what's his name, Hammack?
Hammond.
After he testified, was there a motion to strike? Was there another objection after his testimony?
There was not another objection after.
So the so when we review this, the way that we should look at it is in terms of what information the district judge had before him prior to trial. If there wasn't another objection, the case turns on what the district judge had before him prior to trial. We put ourselves in the same position as him. What was actually testified to really seems to me of no moment because there was not another objection. Do you agree with that?
I would say that's correct.
Yeah, and the only thing the district judge had before him was the FBI 302 and the representations of counsel.
I would say that's correct.
Okay.
Whatever the district court...
synopsized is somewhere in the briefs. Was there any material difference between the substance of the 302 and the testimony?
I don't recall a material difference between the two.
No, I think there was. It's actually printed in here somewhere. Let's take a look at it.
But I'm not sure that the 302 was marked at evidence as evidence and admitted.
No, it wasn't.
It doesn't have to be.
It may certainly have been a proffer, but by the same token, the proffer was made that Mr. Davis disputed that money had been transferred.
Here's the proffer, the relevant parts, I think. Davis said the money had been deposited into the payroll account. But Hammack replied, Davis, I'm telling you, I've gone through the records and it didn't. Davis then unexpectedly said, what will it take to make this go away? Hammack responded that Davis needed to repay whatever you took. Davis asked, what if I split the $29,000? Hammack told Davis the amount of missing money was in excess of $100,000, to which Davis responded, oh, I can't pay that much. So that's what we're working with here. Is there a dispute about missing funds?
There is a dispute about missing funds because Mr. Davis never recanted his statement or never changed his initial statement that the money had been transferred to the payroll accounts. He didn't say, okay, it's been transferred. He said, no, what can we do to split this? If there are financial irregularities, I'm the treasurer, they fall to me. What can I do to resolve that? Because that's my responsibility. This is no different than any other offer to compromise where the responsibility falls to Mr. Davis. This under the rule talks about the reason that offers to compromise often should not be admitted is because they may actually be offers to buy peace.
So here the district judge says, look, there's an internal investigation going on, whether the district judge knew at the time there was also an FBI investigation going on. He says this was not, in the nature of trying to determine whether the money had been stolen. This wasn't a civil dispute.
I'd submit that many civil disputes start out, many criminal cases start out as civil disputes, trying to decide whether money had been stolen. If Mr. Hammond knew where the money was, the conversation is doesn't help him investigate anything further. The conversation, if everything is settled, then Mr. Hammond doesn't need to say, Mr. Davis, where is the money? If the money is already stolen and not transferred.
Where is the money is not part of the not part of the proffer. He confronted Davis with the checks made payable to Davis' explanation. The money was deposited to the payroll account.
I understand that the court is referring to the 302, but counsel filed a motion in limine, and we also made representations. And we made representations that are consistent with the trial testimony. I don't mind if the court will allow me to refer to the motion. In those representations, I'm sure that we represented that Mr. Davis disputed that the money had been stolen and, in fact, said the money had been transferred. Once that occurs, until Mr. Davis says, you are correct, the money has been stolen, there is a dispute. Once again, I understand that ultimately Mr. Davis was convicted on 10 of the 12 federal counts. But I'd also say to the court, he took the stand and, well, I understand the court doesn't want to actually reach what happened at trial, but my desire to reference it is solely to show that the dispute started from the time Mr. Hammond first addressed Mr. Davis and lasted throughout. And there was no inconsistency. There was never a time.
Would you agree that the district judge also, he didn't use the word obstruction, but he used the words conceal, that Mr. Davis was, this was just part of an ongoing effort by Mr. Davis confronted with an internal investigation about whether he stole money from the fraternity, that this was an ongoing effort on his part to conceal his illegal activity. Now, that he didn't use the word obstruction, but it sure sounds like what he's saying is he's trying to obstruct the investigation.
That does sound like it, but the problem with that conclusory statement is that there's no evidence of actual concealment. There's no evidence of hiding. Nothing that Mr. Davis says or does is to hide or mislead or point in a different direction. We have a difference of opinion. We have a dispute.
I deposited these in the payroll account. Answer, no, you didn't. No attempt to conceal there on the part of Davis?
Absolutely not. That's a dispute because it requires the district court to take one side over the other.
Yeah, I know it's a dispute, but you know, the any time you invoke the exception under 408 for obstruction of an investigation, there's going to be a dispute unless the defendant pleads guilty. You know, if the defendant says I didn't do it, and somebody else accuses and says yes you did, that's a dispute. But I don't know, the exception would never apply if it's just because there's a dispute, as long as the guy pled not guilty.
That's exactly what I'm saying, though, Your Honor. If there is only a dispute and there is not actual obstruction, 408 does apply, and there is no exception. The statement should not be admitted. But once you have something else, once you have some evidence of actual concealment, and I'd submit that concealment is not necessarily admissible. Evidence of concealment is not necessarily admissible, but some evidence of, let's say, obstruction in order to invoke the exception to Rule 408, and you simply have no evidence that Mr. Davis attempted to obstruct. You only have the only way that you can get to that is to decide that no money made it into the payroll account. The evidence at trial established that money did actually make it into the payroll account. That is why restitution amounts were reduced. So we may have,
I think another answer, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but there seems to be two other answers to my question. One is, number one, the government has never argued obstruction, and number two, at least to us, they did argue it in the district court. Why they're not arguing it now, I don't know. But and the second is that there's an ambiguity in that part of Rule 408 because it says you can use the evidence for the purpose of proving an obstruction of an investigation. But it doesn't seem to me that this evidence was offered to prove obstruction. It was offered to prove consciousness of guilt.
That's absolutely right. And that is why that is what the rule prohibits. That is why it was so prejudicial to Mr. Davis. Nothing really could be more prejudicial than a statement admitting to the crime by the defendant. I see that I've exceeded my time. I did want to address the constructive amendment because that prejudiced Mr. Davis as well.
Well, you've gone way over and well past your rebuttal time, and the case, that matter is fully briefed, so I think we should call it for now.
Thank you.
Give you some time for rebuttal. Unless you have questions about
that. No, I don't have any questions about it.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Catherine Kelly on behalf of the United States, and with me today is Elizabeth Trostman from the Appellate Division and Michael Atkinson, the trial attorney from this case. Your Honors, the trial court was correct. It did not abuse its discretion in admitting the conversation between Mr. Hammack and the defendant. In order to have this Rule 408 apply, both parties need to know that there's some sort of settlement negotiations or discussions going on at the time. Rule 408 isn't meant to immunize all statements by a defendant just because they disagree as to where the money went, which is what was going on in this case.
So who was not aware of this here?
Well, Mr. Hammack certainly wasn't aware in calling the defendants in July or August of 2003 that he was entering into any sort of settlement.
Well, he may not have intended that. He may not have anticipated it, but when he got an offer, he said, if you want to negotiate, you'll have to negotiate with the board.
Which indicates that he clearly was not in a settlement negotiation.
It clearly indicates he received what he understood was an offer of settlement.
Well, he received something, but just because some one side decides that they're going to blurt out an offer, which all the evidence shows was quite unexpected from Mr. Hammack's point of view.
What in the rule requires that it be expected?
Well, there is case law to show that at least both parties have to know there's some sort of settlement discussions going on.
That's exactly the point. The treasurer or the new person, Hammack.
Mr. Hammack, yes.
Acknowledged that's what was going on and said that's not my department.
Well, he said something along the lines of, if you're trying to make some sort of offer, you need to talk to the international president.
I don't think we can consider that, actually, because that was in his testimony. It wasn't in the FBI 302.
It was in his trial testimony, yes.
Right.
But even still, when you look at the statements that he made, when you just look at what's written in
here's the 302.
Motion.
Davis then unexpectedly said, what will it take to make this go away? Hammack responded that Davis needed to repay, quote, whatever you took, close quote.
Which actually wasn't his trial testimony.
Well, this is what I thought we just established. We're dealing with
right.
The proffer. Hammack responded he would need to repay whatever you took. Davis asked, what if I split it? Hammack says the amount missing is more than 100. I can't pay that much. This sounds like a negotiation to me.
The trial court just recently, and I filed this a couple of weeks ago, the trial court's recent decision discussing or denying Mr. Davis' release pending appeal discussed the merits of the 408 issue and cited a case, Lee Middleton, Original Dolls versus Seymour Mann from the Eastern District of Wisconsin. And that court stated that essentially one party can't make the other party privy to settlement negotiations against that other parties will, and that both sides need to assent to settlement discussions to invoke Rule 408 in the first place, where you have a conversation going on where, from the motions in limine, it shows that the fraternity.
This is a district court?
This is a district court case. It was, if Your Honors need to cite it.
If one party says, look, I hereby offer to give you $100,000 to settle the matter, and the other party says, I refuse to negotiate with you, that evidence comes in under your theory?
That evidence does come in. If you're talking to somebody who's not in a position to to negotiate if the conversation started at a point where the
offers of compromise are covered by the rule.
But some sort of negotiation has to be going on, some sort of discussion. You certainly can't call up anybody at a company and say, I want to settle your...
If an offer of compromise is covered by the rule, there's nothing about an offer that requires the other side to do expect or respond in any way.
Well, there's still
an offer. It's not an acceptance. It's not a rejection. It's an offer.
Well, you still also have to have an actual dispute. And
I don't think so. The rule says that the following can't be admitted into evidence. This is offering. I'm going to shorten it up. Offering or promising a valuable consideration in compromising or attempting to compromise a claim.
Which first requires A, that there be a claim, and B, as
well, the claim was 29,000 is mentioned, then it's up to 100,000. That's the claim, right?
The claim is that he didn't know where at that point the fraternity is saying they've detected that there's some cash missing and that they don't know where it went. So it's hard to even say that there's a claim that's actually formulated.
Well, they didn't call him by random dialing. They called him because they're looking for the money, right? They think there's 29,000. Well, they think there's 100,000 missing.
It depends. If I was allowed to refer to the trial testimony, that's not the nature of how the call came about.
That's not what the district judge ruled on.
No.
Ruled on the proffer.
That's correct. But there was a conversation where they're wondering where the money went, and they're trying to figure that out, which is... In the motion says that the fraternity had detected some but not all of the checks that had been made payable to cash at that point, which indicates the fraternity.
The district judge reasoned that the rule protects settlement negotiations in civil matters. It does not protect efforts to settle a criminal matter, and that what's going on here is, in fact, an effort to forestall a criminal investigation, first initially by the internal investigation of the fraternity. I don't hear you arguing that.
And I
don't see in your brief an argument, which is in the nature of a kind of, it's like obstructing a criminal investigation. The rule doesn't say the criminal investigation has to be by the police or the FBI. It just says a criminal investigation. And the judge here said, they're trying to determine whether somebody stole their money. But there's nothing in your brief that I saw that says anything about obstruction, the obstruction exception, right?
Well, we talked about a number of cases, the Gale case from the DCCA. We talked about the restatement of contracts, which says that if you're just offering to pay back money that you owed anyway, you're not giving valuable consideration. The Chemtall case on page 32 of our brief saying that settlement communications shown to have obstructed a criminal investigation, just as a settlement communication shown to have obstructed a criminal investigation is admissible under Rule 408, so too is a party's communication aimed at forestalling a civil investigation of a massive financial fraud, which would be akin to the fraternity trying to figure out how much money had been taken. That was on page 32 of our brief, Your Honor. It's the case is Chemtall Incorporated versus CityChem. It's at 992 F Sup 1390. It's a Southern District of Georgia case from 1998.
Oh, this is in a parenthetical. I don't read parentheticals.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, if Your Honor reads the Chemtall case, it's a direct quote of most of what it said about it's essentially you don't have to wait till there's a criminal investigation going on to say you can't hide your statements behind Rule 408 if what you're really trying to do is stop the entity that's looking into the matter from looking any further. And our argument was, as one of our arguments in the brief, that he's really just trying to get the fraternity to stop looking. He knows at the point they have the conversation that the fraternity is aware of $29,000 of missing money. And our point, both at trial and now, is that Mr. Davis was in a much better position at that point than the fraternity to know exactly how much was missing. Mr. Hammack was able to say during the conversation, well, we know there's more than 100,000 missing, but ultimately when this all came out in the wash, there was, even with his small payments back into some of the fraternity's funds. There was over $200,000 missing.
How does this bear on a ruling in limine?
It bears on a ruling in limine in that it's clear that...
It's clear that you're bootstrapping from the evidence at trial when the issue was the admissibility of this.
Well, even looking at directly what's in the record at the time the ruling was made, when you look at the statements from the conversation, we have Mr. Davis saying, what if we split the $29,000, which obviously came from some discussions about the amount
missing. That's not what he said.
Missing.
What if we split?
What if I split the $29,000?
What if I say to make this
right.
go away?
I
what
mean, he's, I not try, he's not offering hammock money.
No. Which is ultimately why we didn't argue obstruction, as if he was trying to pay off a witness
you know,
or,
if this,
or anything.
If this were a person trying to avert a criminal investigation, and after saying, what if I split the $29,000, and hearing hammock say back that the amount was in excess of $100,000, would it be plausible that he would respond, oh, I can't pay that much? If he's trying to avert a criminal investigation, which will, as you point out, ultimately reveal a much larger sum, surely the proper response would be, or the expected response would be, let's work something out. I don't have it all right now.
Well, I mean, that's essentially what he's saying. I can't pay that much, you know. You can interpret that as two people that know each other.
That seemed to be the end of the proffer.
Yeah, that was the end of the proffer.
So.
I can't pay that much can be interpreted as have a little mercy on me. I don't have that money. That still doesn't exclude the fact that at that time, Mr. Davis knew or should have been well aware of the fact that he had taken over $200,000 from the fraternity.
There you go again.
I'm not talking about the trial evidence at that point. I'm talking about what he knew in his mind at the time.
You can't say that except for the trial evidence. You can't say that except for the conviction. You want to make 408 depend on the outcome of the trial, basically.
In which case
it could be just removed from the rule book.
No, what I'm saying is that ultimately, regardless of whether this case ever went to trial, Mr. Davis knew or should have known at the time of this conversation exactly how much money he took from the fraternity.
If he took any.
How
do we know he took any? Because something occurred later at trial, right, based on this, in part on this evidence.
Well, that's how we knew that he took the money. However, he in his own mind ought to have been well aware, since he'd been writing checks to cash over a course of several years at that point, which amounted to far more than $100,000.
You want us to take the conviction and the conviction as establishing a fact when the conviction is based on the disputed evidence.
Well, even if you just took the $29,000 that's mentioned here and then Mr. Hammock's statement that the missing money was in excess of $100,000, you still, just looking back at Mr. Davis's statement that, what if I split the $29,000, he's still thinking that he's getting one over on the fraternity by saying, maybe I can get this guy to let me off the hook for $29,000 or half of $29,000.
Well, that sounds like an offer of settlement.
Not if you've stolen money from the fraternity and taken it for your own use, and now you're ultimately trying to get the fraternity to stop looking into the issue
any further.
At this point,
it could have been negligence in his handling of the affairs. Right? We just don't know.
Were you going to respond? I
would just say that I would point to Mr. Davis's statement again from what was proffered in the motion in limine, and Mr. Davis said, what will it take to make this go away, is not the sound of a statement of somebody
what
who's
if he had
saying,
said,
I goofed
what
up,
if he had
I'm
said,
a terrible
look, I didn't take any money, litigation's very important, expensive, and I can't afford it. So what will it take to make this go away?
Yes, but that's not what he said.
I understand that. What does it take to make this go away doesn't tell us that he isn't thinking about the expense of litigation as opposed to possible criminal liability.
Well, it also doesn't tell us that he is just somebody who thinks he's made an accounting mistake. I think you can read more into it than I'm a terrible accountant and I just want to get this out of my way as quickly as possible.
You could be saying, I'm a perfect accountant, but there's litigation's expensive.
Yes, we would submit that that's just really not what the statement says, so.
Because there's no, at this point, there's no criminal element in the background, right? There's no one has said we've referred this to the.
There's no evidence that anybody had told Mr. Davis that had been referred. The timing of the referral to the FBI is somewhat unclear, if I may refer to the trial testimony. Mr. Davis was removed from the Office of Treasurer on the 24th of June, 2003, and the trial testimony from, I believe, President Thomas said that he referred it to law enforcement sometime after that. And then Agent Stanley from the FBI said that he got on the case in October of 2003 and that had been referred down to the Washington field office.
This conversation took place in July or August.
Either July or August. So it's unclear from the trial transcript whether or not the case had been referred.
The first time we know it's been referred is October.
Yes, and perhaps slightly before that because it came from the Philadelphia office to the D.C. office. And I do believe that also, in addition, there is evidence of concealment here, contrary to what the defense counsel has said. We would assert that he used, as we'd said earlier, used the conversation to conceal the true amount of his theft. He knew that he understood from the conversation that the fraternity knew of $29,000 in missing money, and he was in a position, again, to know that there was much more money than that missing. So by just offering to split the $29,000, it indicates that he was trying to conceal the true nature of his crime.
The entire FBI 302 was, I was looking, I haven't found it yet, but I thought I remembered that the government attached it to its opposition, because the portion that we've been relying upon is only a portion of the 302 regarding this particular witness. It begins on page 2. Do you know if there's any more to the 302 than that's relevant to this particular matter?
Trial counsel has just indicated that he's not sure of whether there is any more to the 302. I'm happy to look into that and provide it to the court.
I couldn't find it in the appendix. Did you file? You filed. There were separate appendices filed.
No, there were not, Your Honor, because everything that we relied on was in the defense appendix, so we didn't file a separate appendix in this case.
Yeah, I thought I had two volumes. The second question I have is, if in fact you are arguing, that the obstruction exception applies here? Under 408,
we are arguing that as it says in our brief, it applies to Rule 408. It applies to litigation and less formal states of dispute, and therefore it's appropriate to hold that people who attempt to buy off those who later become prosecuting.
But
witnesses.
The exception seems to me, and I said this to Mr. Axum, that it says you could admit it for the purpose of proving an obstruction of an investigation, but the government never offered this evidence for that purpose.
No, we admitted it for consciousness of guilt.
So the exception can't possibly apply. Right?
Well, I believe it can be under Chemtall. It's just if you're trying to forestall a civil investigation.
Check it. It says permitted uses, and then it says proving an effort to obstruct a criminal investigation. That's a permitted use, proving an
That's
effort
correct.
To.
All right. Okay. But we admitted it to show consciousness of guilt, arguing that there wasn't a claim in dispute at the time, and that these discussions were not settlement discussions, and therefore it didn't fall within any of the prohibited uses in Section A.
So I want to ask you about a different argument that the defendant is making, and that relates to the wife's proffer testimony and the hearsay question.
Yes, Your Honor.
Now, some of her testimony was clearly not hearsay. For example, she was going to testify that she saw her husband prepare money orders in their home, right?
That's correct.
That's not hearsay. Okay. And she was going to testify that they didn't use money orders uh, to to pay their personal bills. That's not hearsay, right? And
that's correct.
Yeah, and also she was going to testify that Pepco and Hartford were not vendors for their family, right? So none of that's hearsay.
Right, those things are not hearsay.
Yeah, okay, so the hearsay issue here is the issue then is she said that she saw him paying bills from Hartford, right? And
yes.
Also that he filled out money orders for Hartford, right? So,
but there was actually more to her testimony than that.
Yeah.
More non-hearsay?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
More non-hearsay?
No, it was hearsay. She was saying that
that's not the focus here. That's on the non-hearsay that was excluded.
Right.
So, no, Your Honor, those items would not be hearsay.
Okay. Wait a minute. I thought you... The district court said that the testimony that she saw him paying bills to the Hartford...
To the Hartford, yeah.
That the district court said, was hearsay.
That would be hearsay.
Okay. And that's what I want to focus on with you. I'm not quite sure I understand why that's hearsay. All she's doing is testifying. She isn't testifying that the fraternity, that she saw bills that established that the fraternity owed money to the Hartford. She's simply saying that I observed him paying bills that had the word Hartford on it.
Well,
so why is that hearsay? It's not a...
Because ultimately the reason that testimony was being offered was to show the truth of the matter asserted, which was ultimately that the fraternity used Hartford insurance and that he was...
No, just that he was writing checks to something called Hartford. Let me focus in on it this way, okay? Mm-hmm. You cite a case in your brief called United States versus Patrick. Are you familiar with that?
Yes, I am.
Okay. And that's the case that involves the receipt for the delivery of the TV set, right?
That's correct.
Okay, and as you point out, the court said that receipt was hearsay to the extent it was being used to show that the defendant's name and address on the receipt proved where he lived, right?
That's correct.
Okay, but you don't mention the other side of the case, which is the court said it was not hearsay to use that receipt to show that there was a document in his bedroom with his name on it.
That's correct.
And why isn't that just like this case? In other words, that's what they're using it for.
Because here we don't even have the document. All we have is her testimony.
Well, but it's got to be the same. I mean, she's testifying. If the document's not hearsay, then her testimony about it's not hearsay.
But because...
Look, it's... Why isn't any... All she's doing is testifying as to the label. Like, for example, suppose you sue me for driving my car into your car, okay?
Yep.
And I say it wasn't my car. And I have a witness who testifies that the car, she saw the accident, and the car that hit your car said taxi cab on it.
Okay.
That's not hearsay. The taxi cab isn't testifying. She isn't testifying that the cab testified that it was a taxi cab. She's testifying as to the label on the taxi cab. It's no different than if she said the car was yellow. And that's what it's being used for here. All she wants to do is say, I saw him pay a bill that said Hartford on it. She's not using it for anything other than that. It's just a fact. It's an observation. Why is that hearsay?
Well, because ultimately what they're trying to do is prove through, after that, speculation on the part of the jury and inferences that the defendant was paying bills that belonged to the fraternity. The mere statement, the Hartford, if you're only using it to show that she saw a bill that said Hartford and nothing else, that's fine. But when you have
And how do you distinguish the side of Patrick that I mentioned to you? What's the difference between allowing the receipt to be used to show his name.
Show his name.
Yeah. I mean, it would be the same as if someone said, it wouldn't be any different than if one of the witnesses said, I saw a receipt with his name on it.
Right. That makes
And that shows that there was a piece of paper in the room with his name on it. And that's all. And that's not hearsay, the court says.
Well, we would say if Patrick, under Patrick, that the testimony here about I saw a bill with Hartford on it is not hearsay, you still have a situation where you're asking the jury then to use that piece of information and make a very long chain of inferences to have any sort of relevance.
No, because his whole theory was, his theory of defense was, I was paying bills to the Hartford. All she's saying, her testimony is limited to one fact, that there was a piece of paper with the name Hartford on it.
But the issue at trial wasn't just that he was paying bills to the Hartford, but that they weren't his personal bills, that he was paying bills on behalf.
And these aren't being used for any of that. This is just a piece of evidence, that's all. The jury can do what it wants with it.
Right, but to do that, the jury needs to make a long string of inferences that, A, he's ultimately that you want the jury to infer.
Well, maybe that's why the jury will ultimately convict him, because it doesn't believe all that. But isn't this just a testifying as to a label on a piece of paper?
Even if it is testifying just to a label on a piece of paper, and even if you say that isn't hearsay, you still have, you could still say that its probative value is far lessened by the fact that you have to make a number of inferences.
Okay, but that's not what the district court ruled. So suppose I don't agree with you about this. You don't say anything at all in your brief about, even if you're wrong, that this error was harmless. At least I didn't see anything about it. Did I miss it?
No, we didn't put that in our brief, Your Honor. We would not concede that it was a harmful error, though.
You wouldn't?
No.
You didn't put it in your brief, though, right?
No, we didn't put it in our brief, but
okay,
I would
not. Okay, so why, assuming I think this is an error, why is it harmless?
Because even without her testimony, you still have Mr. Davis himself getting on the stand and saying that he had purchased money orders and had used them to pay fraternity expenses.
Yeah, and the government said no witness corroborated that. There's just one witness, him. And if she had been able to testify, the government couldn't have said that.
But there's still even with
right? His, isn't that right?
You could say that it gave some corroboration, but it would argue certainly that it was very minimal corroboration, given that if you're not...
Well, if the jury acquitted on two of the counts, so it didn't think this defense was totally implausible. At least that's one reading of it, so...
It acquitted just on two.
Two, right.
Out of ten.
Yeah, so... I mean, how can you say that's harmless, given the fact that you have the acquittal on two, and that one of the major arguments the government made here was that no one else... This was uncorroborated. Just one witness said that. No one else did.
Well, I don't frankly think that the strength of her testimony would have been much corroboration at all if you're going to limit her testimony only to a statement that I saw a piece of paper in our living room that said Hartford on it and nothing else, then that really doesn't corroborate much at all.
I thought it was undisputed that the fraternity bills came to his home.
Some of the fraternity bills came to his home.
But that was undisputed, right? Wasn't it?
There was testimony both that some of them came to his home and that some of them went through this voucher system where they went to the headquarters of the fraternity. It depended on what the bill was, and it frankly didn't seem like there was any sort of set procedure for particular bills. Mm. But even given that, you still have the defendant's very lengthy testimony about him buying money orders because the vendors wouldn't take the fraternity checks. You have him talking about paying frat expenses himself, paying himself reimbursement for board members' travel and so forth. So he had a very lengthy opportunity to talk about where the money went and what he was claiming to have done with the money. And we don't believe that Ms. Davis's testimony would have added anything that would
testimony would have been that I saw him writing money orders.
Yes, but even he said that, though. He just said, I wrote money orders because...
Yeah, but the jury doesn't have to believe him. Under Rule 403, a brick is not a wall. You build it piece by piece.
That's correct, but even if you were allowing her to testify, I saw him writing out money orders without giving any information as to what those money orders were.
Wasn't her testimony that I saw him writing money orders to the Hartford?
One of her proffer was that she saw some more money orders written out
to Hartford.
To the Hartford.
Yeah.
Plus, and that she could see.
That would be pretty significant evidence for him. That would be pretty significant corroborative evidence.
She also said they didn't use money orders to pay their own bills.
Right.
That's correct. So, but again, he's saying the same thing.
She wasn't allowed to say that. Yeah, but as I said.
Saying it is not quite the same.
As I said, she, you know, the.
We would just submit.
You say here. I'm just finding out my notes here. The government actually said, look, his whole case rests on only one witness, himself.
That's and it. Five character witnesses, I believe, who testified about his truth and
veracity. Yeah, but not about this.
On this subject, he was the only witness.
And that's what the government told the jury.
Yeah, they pointed that out. He's the only one.
Right.
Any further questions?
No.
Okay. Thank you very much, Ms. Kelly.
I respectfully request that the judgment be affirmed. Thank you.
And Mr. Axum, you take 2 minutes for rebuttal, not repetition, but rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honor. With regard to the testimony of Ms. Davis, what the government is really saying is that it doesn't like the inferences to be drawn from that testimony. And if the testimony is relevant is not hearsay, the government has to live with the inferences. The government was not going to be foreclosed from cross-examining her, from testing what she said she saw and her corroboration of Mr. Davis's testimony. And as the court correctly notes, corroboration was important in this case. Otherwise, the government wouldn't have argued that it was only Mr. Davis.
The district judge has the authority under the federal rules of evidence to exclude relevant evidence, right?
That's correct.
If its probative value is substantially outweighed by its prejudicial effect.
That's correct.
And prejudice includes confusion of the jury, right?
That's correct.
And Judge Walton, in this case, didn't use the word confusion, but he said that if I allow the non-hearsay portions of the testimony to come in, it would lead the jury into pure speculation, which sounds to me like he's exercising his discretion under the rule to exclude probative evidence or relevant evidence. Why was that an abuse of discretion? We give the district judges a lot of slack when it comes to that kind of an evidentiary ruling.
I understand. And it was an abuse of discretion because Judge Walton said that all of her testimony rested on hearsay. I don't think he actually considered letting part of the testimony in. Had he considered letting part of the testimony in, he still didn't identify what part of it is confusing. It's simply a corroboration that Mr. Davis paid bills.
I agree with you that the colloquy that occurred is not so easy to follow. But at one point, I recall him simply saying, well, the only thing she can testify is that there were bills from the fraternity in the house, and he was writing out checks or money orders. And so they'd have to speculate that, number one, the bills were fraternity bills, and number two, that the writing of the whatever he was writing, the checks or the money orders, was in payment of those bills. And then Judge Walton, I think at another point, said that even if the jury engaged in that speculation, they'd also have to speculate that in fact he mailed the checks or the money orders to the entity identified on the bills, and there's no evidence of that. Do you remember that? Because you were part of the exchange. So.
Yes.
You were talking about the mailbox rule, right? You invoked the mailbox rule.
Yes, that's correct. But I would still say that it was an abuse of discretion because Judge Walton did not balance that possibility against Mr. Davis's right to present his defense. And any confusion, I'm still at a loss to understand the precise the precise confusion that the jury would have faced. But when it bumped up against Mr. Davis's right to present witnesses, and even if marginally relevant,
There's no such thing as marginal relevant. It's either relevant or it's not relevant.
I agree. I was using the government's language, and
I know the government's wrong. See United States versus Foster. Yeah.
Because it was relevant, there had to be some balancing, and here the balance should have tipped in favor of Mr. Davis, and it didn't. With regard to the harmlessness, this court should certainly resolve any question about harmlessness in favor of Mr. Davis because the government didn't argue it.
Yeah. Well, but we have cases where we say, even if the government doesn't argue it, we go through the analysis.
I understand, yes, the court.
So what would you say about harmless error then in response to what government counsel said? Assuming you're right about the hearsay, that this was not hearsay.
Well, I'd say what the court has already said, what I said in the brief, is that this was a crucial witness. There was only one fact witness that testified, and it was Mr. Davis. And Mr. Davis took the stand after the court denied Mrs. Davis's testimony, and he took the stand and said, because you have denied my wife's testimony, I am taking the stand. So not only did it impact his right to present a defense, but it indirectly, I guess, impacted his right not to testify because it factored into that calculation. It was certainly harmful to him, and once again, if there is the slightest doubt about harmlessness, the doubts should be resolved in Mr. Davis's favor under this court's precedent.
Further?
No, I'm not.
Thank you, Mr. Axsom. Ms. Kelly, thank you. Case is submitted.